Welcome to our podcast, The Screwtape Letters, Confronting Evil in Our Time. I'm Ian Faith.
And I'm Galen Belinsky. In each episode, we will unpack one of C.S. Lewis's 31 letters and illuminate the nefarious schemes that the devil and his minions play in our world today.
Understanding how the demonic forces seek to separate us from God helps us to expose them,
reject them, and pursue Jesus as the center of our lives.
Subscribe and join us and our guests on this journey, The Screwtape Letters.
My dear Wormwood, even under Slubgob, you must have learned at college the routine technique of sexual temptation, and since for us spirits this whole subject is one of considerable tedium, though necessary as part of our training, I will pass it over. But on the larger issues involved, I think you have a good deal to learn. The enemy's demand on humans takes the form of a dilemma. Either complete abstinence or unmitigated monogamy. Ever since our fathers' first great victory, we have rendered the former very difficult to them. The latter, for the last few centuries, we have been closing up as a way of escape. We have done this through the poets and novelists, by persuading the humans that a curious and usually short-lived experience, which they call being in love, is the only respectable ground for marriage, that marriage can and ought to render this excitement permanent, and that a marriage which does not do so is no longer binding. This idea is our parody of an idea that came from the enemy. The whole philosophy of hell rests on recognition of the axiom that one thing is not another thing, especially that oneself is not another self. My good is my good, and your good is yours. What one gains, another loses. Even an inanimate object is what it is by excluding all other objects from the space it occupies. If it expands, it does so by thrusting other objects aside or by absorbing them. A self does the same. With beasts, the absorption takes the form of eating. For us, it means the sucking of will and freedom out of a weaker self into a stronger. To be means to be in competition. Now, the enemy's philosophy is nothing more nor less than one continued attempt to evade this very obvious truth. He aims at a contradiction. Things are to be many, yet somehow also one. The good of oneself is to be the good of another? This impossibility he calls love. And this same monotonous panacea can be detected under all he does, or even all he is or claims to be. Thus, he is not content, even himself, to be a sheer arithmetical unity. He claims to be three as well as one, in order that this nonsense about love may find a foothold in his own nature. At the other end of the scale, he introduces into matter that obscene invention, the organism, in which the parts are perverted from their natural destiny of competition and made to cooperate. Yes, his real motive for fixing on sex as the method of reproduction among humans is only too apparent from the use he has made of it. Sex might have been, from our point of view, quite innocent. It might have been merely one more mode in which a stronger self preyed upon a weaker, as it is indeed among the spiders, where the bride concludes her nuptials by eating her groom. But in the humans, the enemy has gratuitously associated affection between the parties with sexual desire. He has also made the offspring dependent on the parents and given the parents an impulse to support it, thus producing the family, which is like the organism, only worse. For the members are more distinct, yet also united in a more conscious and responsible way. The whole thing, in fact, turns out to be simply one more device for dragging in love. Now, here comes the joke. The enemy described a married couple as one flesh. He did not say a happily married couple or a couple who married because they were in love, but you can make the humans ignore that. You can also make them forget that the man they call Paul did not confine it to married couples. Mere copulation for him makes one flesh. You can thus get the humans to accept as rhetorical eulogies of being in love what were in fact plain descriptions of the real significance of sexual intercourse. The truth is that wherever a man lies with a woman, there, whether they like it or not, a transcendental relation is set up between them, which must be eternally enjoyed or eternally endured. From the true statement that this transcendental relation was intended to produce and, if obediently entered into, too often will produce affection and the family, humans can be made to infer the false belief that the blend of affection, fear, and desire, which they call being in love, is the only thing that makes marriage either happy or holy. The error is easy to produce because being in love does, very often in Western Europe, precede marriages which are made in obedience to the enemy's design, that is, with the intention of fidelity, fertility, and goodwill. Just as religious emotion very often, but not always, attends conversion. In other words, the humans are to be encouraged to regard as the basis for marriage a highly colored and distorted version of something the enemy really promises as its result. Two advantages follow. In the first place, humans who have not the gift of continence can be deterred from seeking marriage as a solution because they do not find themselves in love. And, thanks to us, the idea of marrying with any other motive seems to them low and cynical. Yes, they think that. They regard the intention of loyalty to a partnership for mutual help, for the preservation of chastity, and for the transmission of life as something lower than a storm of emotion. And don't neglect to make your man think the marriage service very offensive. In the second place, any sexual infatuation, whatever, as long as it intends marriage, will be regarded as love, and love will be held to excuse a man from all the guilt and to protect him from all the consequences of marrying a heathen, a fool, or a wanton. But more of this in my next. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape.
All right, here we go. Screwtape Letters podcast confronting evil in our times. Letter number 18. Ian, we're talking today about love, talking about sex, and the way that the enemy works to kind of draw us away from the understanding and appreciating those things the way God intended.
Absolutely. And also digs into marriage, the ideas around marriage, what it should mean, how it should be put together, how people find each other, and the concept of becoming one flesh as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think he starts right in that first paragraph, kind of makes another reference to another underlord demon, or I guess this wouldn't have been an underlord, probably somebody, maybe a college instructor, Slubgob, yeah. As he's known.
The greatest name.
and he talks about he says, I don't want to get into all the tedious issues. You learned all the details. And what I think he's talking about there is really, like, all of the ways that you can, like, sexually tempt, you know, your man and your subject.
It's tedious for them, right? It's so bloody easy.
Right, and there's a million ways to do it.
Yeah.
You know, human sexuality is complicated, and there's a million ways from Sunday to pervert it. But what he's getting at in this chapter is it's almost like he's saying, I just want you to zoom out and look a little bit big picture about sex and marriage and love. Let's look at the big picture. Let's not talk about the tedious stuff.
Yeah, and I like the way he goes straight in and within the first paragraph here and moves away from, let's just not talk about sexual temptation that is so easy.
Right.
There's a myriad of ways to do it, but let's dig in deeper. And he talks about men's dilemma around the idea of abstinence or monogamy being the choice,
mm-hmm.
and monogamy obviously within marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's a dilemma because of how easy it is to tempt, especially men, with easy sex.
Oh yeah, you know? I mean it's kind of the standard demonic tempter, and it's one that every guy falls for in some way, shape, or form.
Well, and you think it's also prostitution's known as what, the oldest tradition, right? Or the oldest.
Transcends a lot of cultures.
Yeah, job out there, right? It's been since the beginning of time. There's been the idea of prostitution. So, yeah, it's just so easy for men to fall into that. I've been tempted in my life with it. I probably fell short many times with that as mm-hmm. well. And I wish I would have read this earlier, because it probably would have made me think differently earlier in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's go a little bit deeper and look at, like, what are the bigger picture ways that falling short in this area kind of draw you away from really what your calling and your purpose is to follow yeah. Jesus. He talks about one of the deterrents to marriage, and he unpacks this concept of what he puts in quotes, which, you know, the human beings call being in love. That he tries to paint this over-romanticized picture of marriage. You know, it's difficult to abstain from sex until marriage and then only have sex in marriage because marriage is a difficult thing. You have this idea of just this beautiful, you know, I fell in love, and unless this emotion of falling in love is there, I shouldn't enter into marriage. And if it falls away, then the marriage is now obsolete and I can walk away from it.
So going back to what we consider the first marriage, right, Adam and Eve, if I remember right, that there's nothing in Genesis that says, oh, and Adam fell in love with Eve, and therefore they got married.
Right.
Right. So right. Is he pointing to the idea that... And the demonic even say it within there that Screwtape points to the fact that, oh, we've got them thinking now that you have to be emotional and you have to be in love to get married, instead of it being a situation where you form a unity to build a family and build a future.
Right. Yeah. He says, the enemy described a married couple as one flesh. He did not say a happily married couple
right.
or a couple who is married because they were in love. But he talks about, you know, God's idea of marriage are two people that come together. And the idea of love is, you know, and don't get me wrong, I love beautiful, romantic, even the cheesy songs. You know, I love all that stuff. I like expressing, you know, I've got playlists for my wife and things like that. But that's not the essence of what love is. It's a great expression. The idea yeah. of falling in love, true love, is a commitment to somebody else's well-being above your own. And real true love is finding your value and your satisfaction in fulfilling the good of another person.
Right.
And that's primarily in the family and in the marriage relationship, but even Christian love, for, you know, brotherly love, the idea is I care about someone else's good over mine, and I actually find joy in bringing about their good above my own good.
Right. And it's interesting, right, because I think they're talking in there with the idea that this has to be something that you're pining about and your heart's breaking. You're so in love with this person. But the idea of telling someone that you love them doesn't have to be that. Like, a friend of mine's just leaving with his family on a mission trip to Uganda. And I even told him, I love you, man. And yeah. I mean, I love you, but I don't sit there going, oh, my heart. it's a, like you said, it's a respect. It's a deep understanding of that relationship, that it goes both ways. And I tell a lot of my friends now, men friends and girlfriends, that I love them, but totally different than the way I tell my wife.
Sure. Sure. But even in a marriage context, you can't hinge your marital relationship and your affection for your wife based off of the feeling of an affection. Because, well, I mean, like, I mean, you've been married for a little bit, you know. 24 yeah. years, all right. Yeah. I mean, you're three times as many years. We just celebrated 7 years.
Congrats.
So you got quite a bit on us. But, like, any guy or any couple that's been married for any length of time knows, like, at some point, the honeymoon does come to an end. Real life hits, and that's when the real... I don't want to say challenge, but that's when the real test begins. The real test of character, the real test of your you know, commitment to your marriage is really going to be challenged. And if it's only fueled by the superficial emotions, it's going to fizzle out like a bottle rocket.
So it's interesting. I know people who have got divorced because they said they fell out of love. And I also have friends who have said, we fell out of love. And then a few years later, I just loved my wife more than I'd ever loved her before. Mm. Emotionally.
Hmm.
And that's, I think, a good thing for listeners to understand who are married. And maybe in that moment with their marriage that they're like, the emotion isn't here anymore. I don't feel the same way for her, or she doesn't feel the same way for me that they did. That this could just be a phase. And it could be a phase that's being influenced by something to break up your marriage.
Right.
Which kind of is the intent of this.
Right.
Planting that seed, whereas once the feeling goes away, this is this Hollywood romanticized idea of falling in love, once that's gone, you know, you have a right to walk away. Oh, it's not working out anymore. I'll jump a little bit to the end of the chapter, but C.S. Lewis, he writes towards the end, he says, "The humans are to be encouraged to regard as the basis of marriage a highly colored and distorted version of something the enemy really promises as a result." In other words, this concept of I've got a deep love for my spouse. He's going to try to trick us as to make that the basis for why we should be married, not the result of a good marriage.
Right.
And there's that phrase, you know, in Western culture, we pick our we get to choose our spouse, and we get to marry the person that we love. You know, we have a dating culture. Other cultures, your spouse is picked for you. And I think the idea of a Christian marriage is you get to pick your love and love your pick. I guess would be the way to say it. It is a matter of like choosing to marry the person that you feel called to marry and love. But then as you're married, continue to commit to loving that person. That's why we have the vows in sickness and in health, right, in good times and bad. Like, it's going to be challenging, but the feelings of love will come through the perseverance of commitment, which is not what the enemy wants us to do, which is why, you know, we have serial monogamy in this country, not, you know, a whole ton of strong marriages.
Right.
Yeah.
Interestingly as well, the idea that I think C.S. Lewis is using in here is that God is love, and love's, you know, so talked about within biblical text that the idea that they then go, well, marriage should be love too. And I think they're connecting the two of them together to force us into the idea that love is, if God is love, then love within a relationship, within a marriage, that must be above everything else, like Uber Alles, right? That becomes what it is.
Well, and I would say that's probably not too far off base, but how do you define love?
Exactly. Going back to your before, right, it isn't just that emotional feeling.
Right. He unpacks, he talks about like that to be means to be in competition. So, I mean, he compares that to really, he actually compares it to the Trinity. There's a little Easter egg here. He talks about God is three in one, and there's a constant deference to the others. The Trinity regards each other. The Holy Spirit exists to illuminate our eyes to see Jesus. Jesus came in order to glorify his Father. The Father sent Jesus to glorify the Son. And it was like, so the Trinity, there's this deference, this love and regard for each other, and that's the model. And C.S. Lewis actually hints at it. He says, the basis of love is actually, you know, God actually designed it so that the basis of human love can even be found in God's own character and nature.
Right.
And it is that I'm not seeking my own interest. It's not a dog-eat-dog world. Sex and love and the pursuit of relationship is not just what I can get out of it, but it's a sacrificial. That's Christ's love. He sacrificed himself on the cross for others. True love in marriage that will drive a lasting marriage is to lay down my own interests and care for the needs of my spouse, but have the joy as if I'm pursuing my own interests.
Correct.
Yeah.
You mentioned that things being in competition. Well, there's a great line in there where he says, Hell's philosophy is, and to paraphrase it, all things being in competition. And I think he also then ties it into, which is for a lot of people who don't believe in God, who would say, well, we're all just animals. He goes into this idea, and this was in the third time in preparing for this, listening to this, this came to me, which is that he actually talks to the point that mankind, humanity, is different from the animal kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives that example with the spider, right?
Right.
She eats him afterwards. And that within the animal kingdom, animals copulate to procreate, and
that only, right?
And that all things are in competition is what the animal world's all about.
Mm-hmm.
Like I always say to people that when you see animals in captivity, they're no longer getting up in the morning going, "Who's going to eat me today?" Or, you know, because all things in the animal kingdom get eaten sooner or later, all of them. Right, so it's this idea about things being in competition, but then it also, I think, flows into the idea of if you can pit people against each other, men against women, men against other men, and the vices of infidelity and adultery and things like that to break up marriages. I love the way he ties all this together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really clever, and it should get, and to our listeners out there, when you're in a relationship, in a marriage, and you're looking at the landscape of your marriage, these are things to consider, which is the natural forces are going to put things in competition.
Mm-hmm.
And try and divide you. And as your life breaks down and a marriage breaks down, I've rarely seen in the divorces that I've seen in my years, people get closer to God through that.
Mm-hmm.
They may come out 18 months later.
Sure.
But within that season, it's a road to hell.
Right.
You know, it's not a good place to be.
Right.
And I also know, and from enough years on this earth, including my mother, who actually said one of her biggest regrets in her life was getting divorced from my father.
Hmm. Hmm. And did you say why?
I think it was making bigger deals out of things at the time than they were in hindsight.
Sure.
And again, I think that's, and it was competition.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships, you know, dynamics, all that pitted people against each other rather than that unity of that one flesh marriage holding things right. together.
It's interesting. Like, nothing will show you your own selfishness like being married. it's like you have a mirror put to yourself, and like, and that would be an encouragement to any person looking to pursue a lifelong covenant of a godly marriage. Get ready to confront your own selfishness.
Yeah,
eat a few slices of humble pie. Take the model of Christ, who was a sacrificial person, and know that it's also your job to see the selfishness in your spouse. So you have to lovingly help your spouse see their own selfishness, and that's a difficult process.
Right.
That's not like, you know, Jason Mraz, you know, these love songs. I mean, that's faded at that point when you get into the reality of marriage, but it's persevering through it that you can experience really godly love. And then also, you know, we haven't talked as much about the sex, but really sex to be enjoyed, to build that unity, to build a marriage, and to build that continual
bond,
the one flesh bond. Yeah.
Because going back to that competition versus cooperation that he puts in there, and I think that's something that you can look at within a marriage and say to yourself, wow, that's really, are we cooperating or are we competing?
Hmm.
Over everything from budgets to decisions to all of that, right? And I think that they become wedges.
Hmm.
Now, I don't think you're ever going to agree on anything 100%. I don't think there's any two people ever will that. My goodness. Not even Adam and Eve.
But at least seeing the paradigm of comparing, like, you know, relationship and competition versus relationship fundamentally in cooperation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you think about it on those very simplistic terms, within moments within your day-to-day marriage, and think, are we competing right now, or are we trying to find that middle ground for cooperation? I think the more you can move towards that middle ground for cooperation, I think that builds a stronger marriage,
mm-hmm.
where the competition side of things just slowly wedges things apart.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get to a situation where you get men who are like, she don't know nothing, I tell her everything to do, or I'm going to be the dominant force. Or you get a woman on the other hand who says, my husband's an idiot, I'm just going to take care of this. And again, they're all little wedges.
Mm-hmm.
And they're demonic wedges, because eventually what happens is people separate. They break up families, kids suffer, and then it becomes a vicious cycle in that respect.
Mm.
So he also says, and he uses this term, you know, about Paul did not confine it or sex to married couples. And I was leaning on you for feedback on this.
Okay, cool. So he gets into the chapter where he gets kind of back talking about sex a little bit, talks about the fact that there's this, you know, God has associated affection between the parties with sexual desire, so sex is something that's supposed to build the relationship, and that literally becomes one flesh. So I read the same thing. I had to think about it for a second. So what does he say here? He talks about the fact that God designed the married couples to be one flesh. Literally talking about the sexual union, you know, to become one. He did not say happily married couple become right. one flesh. If you're married, you're one flesh. Become a happily married couple. But he says you can also make them forget that the man they call Paul did not confine it to married couples, talking about the fact that they become one flesh. So at first I read that and say, oh, it seems like Paul's endorsing sex outside of marriage. So I was actually driving over here thinking about it a little bit more. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 16 through 18. He says, or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it was written, the two will become one flesh. 1 Corinthians 6:16. So what he's saying is, Paul says, even if you have sex with a prostitute, you're becoming united right. with her. It's what C.S. Lewis refers to as that transcendental union. Something supernatural happens when you have sex with somebody, even if it's a prostitute, even right. if it's a one-night stand. So that was Paul's point, and that's what C.S. Lewis is referencing. And he says, make them forget that. Because, oh, if you just have cheap sex one night, it's not a big deal. Whereas Paul's word is actually to the believer, even if you do it once with a stranger, something supernatural, you become one flesh. Save that for what God intended,
right?
The marriage bed, not the dating bed.
So for listeners who are reading their Bible, the first reference to marriage is obviously within Genesis. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. You know, that's Genesis 2, 24. And then it's interesting that Matthew, and this is a question I have for you as well, that reading Matthew 19, right, where he actually requotes that, but then at the end says, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard people talk that that's divorce. Is it let men not separate adultery? As in other men? Or men being men and women, mankind?
I wouldn't want to be the man on either end. I wouldn't want to be the man who's married to a woman and had to leave the relationship to the point where it needed to be terminated. I wouldn't want to be the man on the outside of somebody else's relationship.
Right.
So I think the let man not separate is... your regard towards the marriage relationship is that everyone's priority should be keeping that strong and being against things in culture that drive it apart. And the things he unpacks in this chapter, basically free sex, you know, outside of marriage. So when he says, let man not separate, I think God is anti-divorce. There are times and occasions and provisions for where it is necessary and the right thing to do. But that's not God's will.
Going back to the point, right? So a lot of people use that let men not separate as a reference to divorce or not being getting divorced. Then I read it again and I'm thinking, wow, well, let men not separate. That's to me also seems like it's a thou shalt not commit adultery.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Nothing should be getting in the way. Not another boyfriend, girlfriend, not an in-law, not an addiction, not a career. Nothing should be getting in the way of that marriage union. That should be the priority in pursuing, you know, a selfless, Trinity-modeled,
right.
selfless love in the marriage so that can be prioritized.
Okay, so takeaways. For me, it's, look, the demonic said at the very start, sexual temptation's easy. You're going to be tempted. You've got to be strong. You've got to be aware that it's coming. And the attacks will get stronger and they'll get more persistent and deeper when you get married, because there's nothing, I think, that the demonic love more than to break up a union that God put
mm-hmm.
together.
Mm-hmm. It also threw out that there's a bunch of stuff in this chapter we didn't even get to. He really highlights the value of family and love and the sexual relationship in marriage producing family, which is even a more unified family unit of love that the enemy detests.
Right.
So, I would even say as a question, what are some of the other things that stood out to you guys in this chapter that we didn't get to really unpack so much in the podcast today? And then lastly, where does that role of the romanticized love fit into a relationship? It's not. It cannot be the only fuel.
Right.
It's a superficial thing. It'll burn out, but it does have its right and it's good and right place in a healthy marriage as well. So don't spare the cheesy romantic songs, you know.
Yeah,
they've got their spot in there as well.
Well, and to leave us with the last thing, which is that he points in there that the demons influence all this through poets and novelists. But I would even say today, especially through music, you know, Hollywood and that whole industry, that they're not working for solid marriages.
Right. And that's the big picture trend. That's the point of this letter. Don't look into the specifics of the temptation. Look at the trends. One's trending towards destruction, people being single, afraid to marry. One's trending towards happy, healthy marriages and families. Look at the big picture. Find out how sexuality plays into that, and pray God's will for your life.
And that's Screwtape Letters 18. We'll see you next time. Confronting evil in our time.
When he talks about Paul, I was thinking of this while I was driving up here. He says, and I didn't mention the chapter because it's not really about the chapter. It's just a little sidebar zinger that the demonic is throwing out there. He says, you can also make them forget that man they call Paul. Mm-hmm. So we call him Paul because he was Saul of Tarsus. Mm-hmm. He had a conversion. He was an evil man. He was a bad man. He should have been condemned. He was an evil, terrible man. He was killing, stoning Christians. He was behind the stoning of Stephen. He had a new identity, a new transformation, and he's a man in Christ. And the enemy will not acknowledge. He will only acknowledge who you were. God wants to call you Paul. Now he's still Saul to us.
Yeah, right.
God wants to say you're healed and restored. Now you're still a scumbag. And the enemy is constantly the accuser of your old identity, not your new identity. And it's that subtle thing. The man they call Paul. And as I bet you even Cleese didn't pick up on that detail. They call him Paul. We call him Saul. He's Saul to the demonic.
Brilliant Easter egg.
Yeah, it's a good one.